The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Emily Day, and this is an episode from the Lawfare Archives for November 20th, 2021. The Somali Civil War has raged on for 3 decades now, and one of Africa's deadliest terrorist groups, Al-Shabaab, remains one of the country's most powerful political and military actors. Just as we saw with the botched withdrawal from Afghanistan in August, the American anti-terrorist campaign in Somalia has been stymied by an alliance with a weak, corrupt government and an unmanageable insurgent group. Some officials have said that the Biden administration could unveil a new Somalia policy in the coming weeks. For this week, I chose an episode from August 9, 2014, in which then-President of Somalia Hassan Sheikh Mohamed spoke with Brookings on the future of his country and addressed the challenges his state faces in its ongoing battle against Al-Shabaab.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 9, 2014. Yesterday, President Mohamed spoke at Brookings on the future of his country. As the U.S.-Africa summit came to an end in Washington, President Mohamed addressed the challenges to democracy that his country faces, and how Somalia, the African Union, and other international partners can work together to ensure security, foster development, and promote stable state building in the country. President Mohamed provides a realistic assessment of his country as it battles militant groups like Al-Shabaab, but looks to bring the promise of democracy to fruition. Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy at Brookings, provided introductory remarks and moderated the conversation. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 87, President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed on the future of Somalia.
Welcome to Brookings, actually to our friends across the street at SEIU. We're grateful for the space here. We're still waiting on some water, but in just a moment we'll get started. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. We are honored today to have the President of Somalia, Hassan Sheikh Mohamed, visiting with us and speaking about his country, its challenges, and the broader region, and all that he's been able to do in his nearly 2 years in office, but all that still remains to be done, which, as you're all aware, is a great deal. But let me say a brief word of welcome to the President, and then once I'm done, ask you to join me in giving him a big Brookings round of applause to welcome him again to Washington, where he's been part of the Africa Leaders Summit, and also just to thank him for the honor of his presence here with us today. But before that, he is a longstanding academic. If he were not president of Somalia, perhaps we'd be offering him a position at Brookings. Maybe someday we could be so fortunate. He grew up in Mogadishu and attended the Somalia National University, graduating there in 1981, doing graduate studies in India, coming back to Somalia, toughing it out through all the difficult years that have been experienced since then, helping found a new university in Somalia thereafter. And Mr. President, I know you were the dean of this Samad University in Mogadishu for a number of years and taught there as well. In between, he had been involved in education to some extent under UN auspices with UNESCO and UNICEF, and also helping start some local schools in Somalia. So a great commitment to education, and now a great commitment to the stabilization of his country and the reconciliation efforts with various elements, various clans and tribes that have often been at war in recent decades, and of course the development challenge that remains ahead, because clearly creating a modicum of stability is just the first step towards helping Somalia truly get back on its feet. A word or two more of background, and then we will please welcome the president. He's now working with an African Union force of some 24,000 soldiers from a number of countries, but four of them in particular with the largest contributions, Ethiopia, Burundi, Uganda, and Kenya, and a number of other participants as well. One of the great encouraging things about this effort, which is showing indeed some true signs of hopefulness, is how much Africa and Africans are working together to deal with their own problems, how the African Union has really stepped up. And yes, there's a long way to go, but this is truly an effort about which Africans can be proud, as their ability to work together as an international group has really been manifested in recent years in Somalia. I think that we will have a number of things to talk about today. I'm going to spend about a half hour with the president in a back and forth discussion, and we will go through a few of the challenges his country is facing, and then we'll open it up to you until about 11:20. Once we get to questions, please state your name clearly after waiting for the microphone. We're fortunate enough to have some television coverage today, and we'd like to make sure your questions get heard as well. But before we get to that, please join me in welcoming the president of Somalia, Hassan Mohamed. Mr. President, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming and giving me this opportunity to talk to such a distinguished group of people in Washington. Just to give you a glimpse of what Somalia is, Somalia is situated in the most corner tip of the African continent, call it the Horn of Africa. Somalia, in general, is a very, very rich country with the largest coastline in the African continent, 3,300 kilometers of coastline on both the Indian Ocean and the Red Sea. It locates a very strategic location, both in the Cold War era and today in this different era. It is in the doorsteps of Bab el-Mandeb and Suez Canal in the Red Sea and the vast Indian Ocean that's open to Asia and until the Cape of Good Hope. So Somalia is located there. Has an estimated population of 10 million people with 8 million hectares of arable land with two permanent rivers throughout the year and number of non-permanent rivers. Somalia has the largest per capita livestock herd in the African continent. So and recently we were told that we have huge reserves of natural resources, gas, oil, and other minerals, which we don't know yet, but that's what at least that has been said by the speculators. So this is the country. Besides that, Somalis are one ethnic group with one language, 100% Muslims, Sunni Muslims, with Shafi school of thought. Until recently, there were other introductions into other new schools of thoughts in the Sunni Muslims. So this is the country, and got its independence in the year of Africa in 1960. Somalia was one of those 17, 18 countries of Africa who got their independence from the colonial powers in 1960. And again, Somalia was one of those African countries who experienced the state failure in 1990. Somalia, Ethiopia, Rwanda, Burundi, Liberia, Sierra Leone. This was a number of African countries that having problem in the 90s. There was no one winner in Somalia after the state collapse. So the war against the state later on became factional war, clan-based war, and it was not easy to reorganize and get back to the mainstream of the statehood. In 2000 was the first time that a transitional government was established in Somalia, and since then there was a successive transitional governments in place until 2012, when we ended the transition after 12 years. The government, the president, is the first non-transitional government in place in almost 22 years. We come through a reconciliation, and different clans get together, reconcile it. established a provisional constitution, nominated a new parliament, which elected the president. And the president appointed prime minister, who established a cabinet of ministers. So that's the Somalia we have. We have a very clear mandate for 4 years, 2012-2016, which we are supposed to bring back all the foundations of a functioning state in place. Building the state institutions on one hand, and fighting and winning the war against the extremists and terrorists on the other hand, is among the set of challenges that Somalia of today is facing. Since we came into the office, we have a very clear program in state building, reaching out the peripheries, linking them to the center, establishing the federalism, established a program called the Vision 2016 that ends in 2016, whereby we want Somalia to have a permanent constitution, federal units in place, electoral systems and political party laws in place, and political parties established, and then people go to elections. Elections which Somalia is going to experience in 2016 after 45 years. The last time when elections took place in Somalia, we can say independent election took place in Somalia was 1969. So after 45 years, Somalia is now heading towards having elections, and the next parliament we expect will come through elections. Some people do believe that still it's not possible. We say it's possible, and we're working on that. People are asking what type of election, what will be the coverage, how far it will be free and fair. All these questions are there, but still we do believe that we can make it, and we are very much committed to make sure that elections happen by the end of 2016. In brief, this is Somalia. Somalia is fighting with one of the difficult wars that the world is facing today, an extremist and terrorist group called Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab is an organization based on ideology, and we all know that ideologies have no citizenship and have no boundaries. Al-Shabaab is Somali for one reason only. They operate in Somalia. They have their base in Somalia. They have their training camps in Somalia. They use Somalia as a transit stage that links Africa and Asia, where the terrorists move here and there. And these organizations, although they have different names, they all are linked some way or the other. There are very clear evidences that Al-Shabaab trained in Somalia and members of Boko Haram in Nigeria, the other part of the continent. Somalia is in the east, Nigeria in the west, and in between Mali, Central African Republic, Chad, all of them. So that's how Shabaab, but its leadership are not Somali. There are more non-Somalis than Somali at the highest level in the leadership. We have people from the America, from North America, people from Europe, people from Asia, the Gulf, the eastern part of the Asian continent. So we have all the kind of people in place, our neighbors in Africa. But still, Somalia has got the name associated with Al-Shabaab. And that's the only reason. And why they operate in Somalia is Somalia has been, there was a vacuum for a long time. So this was a very breeding ground for them. In the last 2 years, the African Union mission in Somalia and Somalia National Army has jointly made operations against the territories that controls Al-Shabaab. And these territories are shrinking day after day, and the plans are now by the end of the year there will not be a territory controlled by Al-Shabaab in Somalia. But that does not mean it's the end of the war. The war will continue. Right now, when they lost the military front, they They just come back to the metropolitan places like Mogadishu, where more than 2 million people are living. They just melt down into the society, and they're doing this hit and run, urban warfare, asymmetrical warfare, roadside bomb, target assassinations, and suicides. So it will take some time. The war is not one of military only. It has multifaceted fronts, economic front. Poverty is one of the... Poverty and grievances are always the two areas where Al-Shabaab benefits within the society. Society that has been without a functioning state over two decades. Wars, conflicts, clan, internal, so displacement. Over 2 million people are not living in their home places in Somalia. Almost 1.5 million outside the borders of Somalia. 500,000 inside as IDBs. So this is the situation in brief in Somalia. But still we have that hope that we can defeat Al-Shabaab. We can put back a functioning state institutions in place, one which is have a strong democratic foundations. We're starting everything from scratch. Maybe in some areas we have better chances than those who want to change systems that have been in place for a long time. So, in brief, this is Somalia. Thank you.
Mr. President, thank you. That's an excellent introduction. I wanted to just make two brief points and then ask a question. One is I want everyone who doesn't remember to understand that this president has his own mandate. He explained to us how there hasn't been an election in a long time, but he was chosen with a strong mandate by his parliamentarians. And so it's in that way that he came to power 2 years ago and enjoys a certain degree of democratic legitimacy, even though we haven't yet been able to see an election in Somalia in recent times. As he points out, there is a plan for that to happen now within a couple of years. Secondly, I was speaking with the president prior to the meeting, and I was consulting a map that was put out by a think tank in London just a few months ago. And I said to him, Mr. President, it looks to me as if you and the African Union are essentially governing maybe a quarter of the country in terms of territory and maybe half or a little more in terms of population. And what he said to me, and I'll give him a chance to further elucidate in a moment, was, well, that map must be a few months old because we're actually doing better than that now. The map may have been correct when it was printed 6 months ago, but we are continuing to expand our control. And there really has been quite a notable progress in the degree to which the African Union and the government of Somalia have managed to consolidate a good chunk of the country, again, without defeating the threat and certainly without having made the necessary progress on the economic and development fronts yet, but nonetheless a very hopeful place. The broad question, if I could, Mr. President, and I'm going to begin with a general question about the region, and we'll get back to Somalia very specifically in just a second, and then we'll stay there with my part of the conversation. But I did want to ask you to speak about the broader threat of extremism in the region, because it's clearly a concern all Americans and many others around the world share. We're waking up today to news about the latest crisis in Iraq. I realize that al-Shabaab may have some ideological affinities with the ISIS group in Iraq and Syria. I would just ask if you wouldn't mind explaining from your perspective how you see the interlinkages between these groups. Are they still on the ascendance? How worried are you about them in a broader regional and global sense? And then we'll get back to Somalia specifically.
Thank you very much, Mike. As you rightly said, this is an ideology, and maybe they have a slight different color in one country or the other, in one continent or the other. But basically, these groups, they have common principles and common ideology that they propagate all over the world, which is the one that is called, that is branded as extremism, everything to the hardliner, to the corner of the spectrum. There is, of course, links between them. Somalis were not. Sometime in early 2000, we were, all of us, with many of our international partners who or academicians who know Somalia, they claim that it's not possible that a Somali become a suicider. We don't have that type of history in the past. We don't have the culture of honor killing. We don't have this type of thing. So no one was believing that a suicide bomber, Somali suicide bomber, would ever come. And it was only late 2005, early 2006, when the first suiciders were being appeared in Mogadishu. Showing the people that they were fighting doing this against the forces that they see as occupiers or things like that. But since then, it has been proven that suicide is not something that belongs to one particular community or country or continent, but it's something that's made by people who knows how to make it, like these terrorist groups, and it has been realized that there are institutions, training camps that produces the suiciders, particularly very young people who still was born in that environment and who has no much vision of what the world looks like. So then how it affects the region and the world is they train people there and they send. That's what happened in Kenya, what happened in Ethiopia, in Uganda, and maybe very far away places. They have training camps, and that's where they brainwash the young people. That's why they show and they teach the people how to do these terror activities. So it's a very serious concern for the region and for the continent and for the world at large. So it is indeed, Somalia is the problem of terrorism is not a Somali problem only. It's a regional, continental, and international. So that's why we seeking the support from the outside world, and we're getting right now one from the sub-region in the African continent, and the world is supporting both the Somali government, the Somali security forces, and the African Union mission to Juba. The question I want to say again and again is that this war is not a military only, and we have experience that military cannot end up the war, but we need to come up with other creating hope. I have a classical example that I always used to say, a boy who was 5 years old in 1990 when the Somali state was collapsing. Today he's 29 years old, and most probably he got a wife and kids. He has never been to school, has never been exposed to any training, so he has not the tools of life in his own hands. There in a very remote area, desperate, doesn't know what to do, cannot offer a cup of milk to his kids. That boy, he simply becomes very, very vulnerable to be recruited by Al-Shabaab. Come and join, and you will have $50 by the end of the month. Or he will be recruited by the pirates. Come and join us. We go to the sea, and in few days or a month, so you have $100,000 with you. So it is a risk taking worth, and this is what makes. And then this age group, unless are the bulk of the society, 65% of the population in Somalia is estimated that aged less than 35 years. So you can understand how huge is the number in the society, and the people is this quality. Even if you provide them an opportunity to employment today, the question is, are they employable? Can they be employed? Using the AK-47 gun does not need much training and does not need any specific qualification, so everybody can hold and use it. So that's the easiest way to earn a life. So developing and providing alternative way of life for those young generation is among the challenges that the Somali government is facing right now. And this is an area where our international partners is showing a minimum understanding. Maybe the world is very ready to support in the security sector, but creating an alternative way of life, providing training facility for them, skills training, and then providing gainful employment opportunity. These are some of the things that proves to be a bit difficult to convince our international partners, but we're doing very, very hard. And we believe that the military campaign is only one part of the war. There are other parts of the war which we have to win also.
Excellent. So let me just ask two more questions in that spirit. First of all, I want to ask a little bit more about your plan for consolidating control in security terms without asking you to give away detailed campaign plans. but with an eye towards where the international community could help more. But then secondly, I want to come back and ask, what can we do as an international community mm-hmm. on the economic and development front, mm-hmm. your concern that you mentioned? And I think between both of these, we'll have the issue of political reconciliation mm-hmm. that I know you think about a great deal. Mm-hmm. So let me ask about security. The trends are favorable. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about the progress of the last year, just briefly, to help people understand that there really is positive momentum. But as you look forward towards your goals for the next 1 to 2 years, could you explain what your concerns are and where you perhaps could use even a little more help or a little more capability to make the odds of success greater than they might currently be for consolidating more control over the country?
Well, security was the top priority of my government at the beginning in early 2013, last year. And since then, we've been working improving the capacity of the security institutions, building the security institutions and professional security forces with national character, not one particular group of the society, but all the different sectors of the society. That was the aim and the plan of the government. The reality in the ground sometimes distracts you away from what you have planned. And the war, on one hand, building the forces, and on the other hand, fighting the war, it was the challenge, as I said earlier. The Somali National Army, the Somali Police Force, and the Somali National Intelligence and Security Agents, these are the three major components in the security sector of Somalia. The custodian corps will follow. Now, we started from scratch converting the militia forces into professional national forces, which, as I said, have a national character. Proves to be very, very difficult, but it's doable, and we're doing. We have not yet completed everything, but we did a lot of progress. Now, we got enough support in that area. The European Union has provided a European Union training mission in Somalia. This mission used to be outside Somalia and training Somalis out. Last year, we agreed to shift them back into Somalia. Now they are in Somalia and they are training inside Somalia. Somalis are training the normal soldiers, but specialized courses, specialized trainings, European Union training mission is supporting. Similarly, the United States is supporting in training special forces, whereby we think the seat of a national army of the future is now beginning with starting with special forces training inside Somalia. So this is going on. Equipping those forces is there still, but we don't have enough equipment yet, but it's supported. And the Somali government has allocated enough of its budget on the security sector, improving the quality, improving the equipment, improving the care of the forces. These are areas that we're concentrating, and it's going well. So that area of security sector development is moving in a very good pace. Regarding the territory, Shabab has been operating almost 11 regions out of the 18 regions of Somalia. The remaining 7 regions mainly were Somaliland, Puntland, where there was relative stability in place for some time. The central regions and the southern regions were the ones that were facing the difficulties of Somalia. Now, the Somali government has succeeded to take over all the regional headquarters of these 11 regions. And now, most of the districts, there were 25 districts that were under control of Shabab last year. Today, there are less than 15 districts that are remaining under their control. And that's what I'm saying, by the end of the year, we are expecting that there will be no one district that's under control of Shabab. But Somalia is a vast area. When you chase them away from the districts and the towns, they go into the rural area. And that's where they remain threat to the community. And they use the means of terror people. If you deal with the government, if you deal with government forces, this is the punishment: beheading, slashing, killings, and so on. So this is how things are going. And now they're changing the tactics into a symmetrical warfare in the urban places. I'm sure that at least we will succeed soon to eliminate all the training camps and all the bomb-making factories in the rural areas. So our war will continue maybe in the urban places. And this will continue for some time. We're not expecting that soon there will not be a suicide bomb or a roadside bomb or things like that. But most of it will continue. In the meantime, we've been developing. One of the challenges was in the Somali laws, we were not having any law for terrorism and all this. It was not part of the norm in the Somalia. So in the courts, the common criminal who maybe stabbed someone with a knife and the one who explodes 100 people in a place, maybe we have the same criminal acts to make them. So many of the Shabab in the past, they walked easily of the courts because of the government's burden of proof for what they did. And the laws we were having, some of the current evidence, electronic evidences, were not evidences in those laws. Now, this has changed now. There's a new act of terror that the Somali government has prepared and is almost now finished. So the treatment of Shabab is now different legally, and the war has now a legal base to fight against the terrorists and those who collaborate with them. So this is the situation in general. But we cannot claim the final victory of the war today. But we are very much, the situation is much, much different than today. The Somali government has succeeded to organize the society, mobilize the whole nation to fight against the Shabab. So the rural nomadic people, the camel herders are today in many parts of Somalia fighting the Shabab, not only the government and the African Union forces, but the society now understood that there's no future without Shabab, and they're fighting. So that makes their days now limited.
Thank you. I'm going to ask one derivative question before going back to the economics and development. And I think you can probably help us here. And this may seem like just a semantic question, but it relates to the broader issue of the international threat. I was careful when I asked you about the international threat not to use the word Islamic extremism. Mm-hmm. I also didn't say jihadist extremism. We Americans are still searching for the right way to describe this threat and understand the threat, because we know that jihad is actually a legitimate activity within Islam, and it's generally not a violent activity. It's a lifelong quest to become closer to one's maker, as I understand it. And therefore, I'm wondering if you can help us understand and properly describe the international threat. I don't want to make this all about a label, but what do you call the broader movement that has its tentacles in your country through al-Shabaab, in Boko Haram in Nigeria, with ISIS in Iraq and Syria, with the elements, the residual elements of Al-Qaeda Central over in Pakistan and the tribal areas, and then also Afghanistan. How do you describe the overall movement? Is it Takfiri? Is it Salafist? What kind of a term do you use?
Well, I would use the term extremism. I would not rather use either jihadist or Islamist or whatever. These are, as you rightly said, are not the right nomenclatures. But extremism, the kamikaze of Japan were not Muslims, the IRA of Ireland were not Muslims, and all of them, they were doing suicide. So it's everything that one gets to the extreme makes him to do that type of behavior, killing mass, the people in mass, killing himself while he's still happy and smiling, feeling that he's victorious while he's killing himself. So this is the nature of when people go to the extreme, whatever basis that, whether it's religious, whether it is nationalism, whether it is something else. So I would have liked to call these people extremists.
Thank you. Let me get back now to the challenge that you said is the one that we've neglected the most as an international community, which is now building on the military and security progress in your country to get to the development challenge, which is the only way to make the security progress durable, as I think I understood you to say. What do we need to do better? Maybe you could begin by telling us a little bit about what you're able to do today, and then that will naturally lead into a discussion of what you think you need to do more and how we can help.
In many times, there is a very clear link between poverty and extremism, poverty and the hope. When people lost the hope, they become very fragile and very easily to be influenced in whichever way, direction. An inorganized group wants people to move, hiring them with very small amount of money, threatening them easily, showing them there is a better way of doing things than just being remain idle. So there are many areas that in Somalia now the question is which comes first, the security, full security and stability to be put in place, and then only we start the development, or a lack of development feeds the insecurity that exists. When the people has no opportunity to leave, the world experience has no chances, then we cannot be secure. And if there is no security, we cannot attract investment and big projects to come so that people get employment and all this. So the whole thing links together. What the approach we're using is that wherever there is a relative security, we need to start some economic activity so that the people can do. And security right now is more of perception than reality. Recently, research indicates that Mogadishu is not among the top dangerous cities of the world. It's not number one, number two, number five, even it's not number six, number seven. There are cities that today, in the eyes of the people, seems to be very secure cities, but research shows that there are more deaths in Mogadishu than more deaths in those cities than in Mogadishu. So security, more of it is perception. Somalia is a wrong place. It has been there. It's a no-go. In 2012, early, many of our international partners called Somalia it's a no-go. And you remember it, that the Prime Minister of Turkey, his family, more of his cabinet were there, and they were moving in Mogadishu, all the corners. And by that time, the young boys and the girls who work in the international NGOs were not allowed to go to Mogadishu because it's not secure. It's not safe enough. So it's more of perception than a reality, the security issue. But the most important thing would I say is that economic endeavor should start. It has to go hand in hand with the security progress we're making. And that's what's happening. Today, Mogadishu is a different place. Roads are rehabilitated well. A lot of people get employment. New hotels emerge. New malls and supermarkets emerge. New business is taking place. So it's moving. And there are a road rehabilitation program that will start soon in the two adjacent regions to Mogadishu, which are the food basket of Somalia, to make at least the agricultural produce reach the major markets easily. Somalia, particularly in the southern part, we started the export of livestock, and in a couple of months we will be starting the export of banana again after almost 18 years. So life is coming back like that. It's a bit slow, but it's coming. And this is very important. In one project in Mogadishu, where there was a training center, was the building of a huge training complex was there. 2,000 people were working for 6 months. After 6 months, it gradually declined, and another 6 months, maybe 1,700, 800 people will go as the project ends. So 2,000 people getting employed today, earning something, was very... So, and that was only one project. When we have number of that projects in different places, now we're going to start 100 kilometer road reconstruction in three different places. So 300 kilometers of road will reconstruction will start soon. So that will be employed. So these are some of the things. And Somalia is getting back to the world arena. Of course, the banana we use it to export to Europe, but today it's not possible because of the quality standards criteria. But still, we have a very large market in the Arabian Gulf, which we can export both meat, livestock, hides and skins, banana, sesame, and many other agricultural produce. So Somalia is just getting back its economic activities alive.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you. Constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
How can we help more? And here I want to make clear, I'm not necessarily asking you to repeat what you might have asked President Obama earlier this week, or what you might have asked any specific member of Congress this week, because I'm sure any such conversations, first of all, might have been private, or secondly, might have been constrained by politics and by budgets. But if we can just put that aside, just to help us think through the real needs in Somalia and where you would like the international community to do more, are there specific kinds of funds, tasks, expertise where we should be trying to find the ability and the resources to do more than we're doing today?
The needs of Somalia, if we just try to list, the list is endless. It's too long. And the challenge is, how do we prioritize those long list of needs? Which ones are the ones that, if we succeed, will become a sort of triggering effect for others to also move forward? So security has been number one priority in Somalia. And then the state building program, building institutions, capacitating the institutions with qualified people, with norms, rules, regulations, procedures put in place so that the old practices will be changed. That itself is another priority area. The third priority area is the issue of economic recovery. The country has been in an emergency state for a long time. Now we are very much focused on moving the country from emergency to recovery, and then from recovery to development. So making that happen, and what we have been presenting to our international partners in the New Deal program last year in Brussels and in London also last year, and here in the United States, is how Somalia can be supported in the issue of the capacity building of the institutions, and then the development of this part of development of human capital, which is training and all this is education, and the development of the infrastructure. When one opportunity exists one corner of Somalia, and the other corner of Somalia, there is a need for that particular facility or opportunity, but it's very difficult to move because there are no roads, there are no bridges, or because there are no human capital that is strong enough to make this thing useful to the country. These are the areas that we have been. So there are sub areas of all of them, but capacitating the state institutions, capacitating the human capital of Somalia, and then developing the infrastructure, roads, energy, bridges, ports, airports, these are. So within each, there are certain sub priorities of where to start, but these are the overall major areas that we have been focusing in the last 1 year or so.
Thank you very much. I'm going to open it up now. So please, once I call on you, wait for a microphone and we'll go from there. Begin with the gentleman here in the second row.
Okay. Thank you, Joe. The issue of TA, the American Somali citizen in Belgium, we have contacted with the Belgian authorities. Our ambassador in Brussels have been constantly engaging. But you see, it is a case that is in the judicial system of the government of Belgium. And we're following closely the case, and our ambassador continuously visits them in the prison. That's the right now what the Somali government, we have been in contact with their lawyers, and whatever necessary information that the Somali government has that supports this case has been provided to them, and just we're waiting the result of the courts. So that's the case in the court, and the Somali government is closely watching and working with the lawyers. Our ambassador is in charge of that in Brussels. Regarding the role of the United States, yes, But Mogadishu, as you rightly said, is not as dangerous as maybe Baghdad and Kabul, but it has one difference. In Baghdad and Kabul, there are American forces in place who at least can guarantee the security of the American staff in the ground. In Somalia, we don't have the American forces in the ground. So it took a bit longer, but now we have an embassy, our embassy here in Washington, opened. We appointed a new ambassador. Similarly, the United States is opening soon its embassy in Mogadishu, appointing a new ambassador, replacing the special representative now we have in Nairobi. And this ambassador and his staff will be placed in Mogadishu, and they will be operating. So that will take the relationship between Somalia and USA a different level. And we expecting that soon will happen. Already facilities are in preparation for the new ambassador that will be coming to Mogadishu. So United States government has already give us the assurance that soon the ambassador will be in Mogadishu. So on right now, the last year we have been, the relationship between United States and Somalia has been improving and making a lot of progress. With the two ambassadors now in place, we are expecting that a further improvement of progress will take place in our relationship. On the other hand, yes, United States is supporting Somalia in the security sector, but not only in the security sector. United States supporting in all. It was major donor, traditional donor of Somalia throughout the years. The only thing is now, the kind of aid that was given Somalia now is different. Mainly, previously it was more focused on emergency, food handouts, water tracking, health facilities like a vaccination. This is needed. Still, the need for that is there. We have been engaging with the United States government to increase the support and to diversify it instead of emergency package only, recovery package, capacitating the state, working with the Somalia, having a new constitution, a new set of laws. All this is the areas where the United States right now is supporting. The support of the United States is not limited to the security sector only. It's very wide.
Next question. Ma'am, here in the third row.
Mr. President, thank you so very much for coming to speak with us today. My name is Deirdre LePin. I'm attached to the Africa Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Before 1990, I was the planning officer for UNICEF in Mogadishu and helped to evacuate the UN from Hargeisa in 1988. So my heart still is very much with the country. I wanted to ask you if you have any plans to harness the tremendous talent of the Somali diaspora around the world. Most Somali extended families have members who live in communities all over the globe. And this talent, their wealth, and their knowledge could do a great deal to rebuild Somalia.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You touched a very important area, the Somali diaspora. The Somali diaspora is a national wealth for Somalia. It is an asset, and it's proving that that asset is very, very useful to Somalia. Today, if you go to Mogadishu, the economic activities that are going on in Mogadishu today mainly is done by the diaspora. The new technologies that are there, the hospitality industry that's emerging now, all these are diaspora-run business organizations. And in other sectors, if you go to the ministries of the Somali government, there is no one single ministry, if you go today, that you will not see four or five diaspora people working in that ministry. Some of them embedded by some partners, some of them, they came there as volunteers. So it's there still. But I think the usefulness of diaspora is more than that. Still, we're working on organizing further but the we're still feeling in the ground the usefulness of the diaspora. They are there, but we're still feeling that more organization and more harnessing is needed to get the maximum benefit out of our huge diaspora that is in both North America and Europe and in the Gulf states. So it's the diaspora is in that situation.
Ma'am, here in the second row.
Thank you for coming, Mr. President. My name is Huda Ibrahim. I am a graduate student at the University of Notre Dame. My question to you is, you mentioned Al-Shabaab and military force. It's not the only solution to defeat Al-Shabaab. And my question to you is there a room for the Somali elders to negotiate between the government and Al-Shabaab? Or is there any other alternative to talk with the other person?
Thank you. Thank you, Huda. My government is a government that come in place through reconciliation, through negotiations, and through dialogue among the different clans, different elders, different social forces that exist in Somalia today. So the door of dialogue is always open. And the government has very clearly articulated the way forward for that. Anybody who denounces the violence, the rest we can negotiate. Whatever ideology he believes, we are ready to negotiate with him. Whatever style of governance in the country that he would like to see, we're ready to negotiate. But the only thing that is negotiable, that's not negotiable, is the violence, killing the people at mass, a lot of them, disturbing the social life, manipulating because of the certain weaknesses that circumstances as compared to the Somali society, benefiting out of that and then changing the social fabric of the whole nation. These are some of the difficult things that are not easy to negotiate or to accept. And we have said a number of times, we have produced a document on that. Publicly, we said the only condition that we have with them is to denounce the violence, period. Denounce the violence, denounce the ideology of Al-Shabaab, which is violence-based, extremism-based. The rest we can negotiate. And that door is open, and we have a very good number of young people who came back through this process of, and we established a center for them so that we can make sure that they are back, and we have people to have a dialogue with these young boys when they are in that center. And then they are given skills training. Some of them, they were young boys who come from different corners of Somalia. And when they went through these rehabilitation centers, we called their elders, and they took back to the community. So it's already there. The mechanism is there. And there's a very good number of young people coming through that. But the top group, the Shabaab, mainly they consist of three groups. One group is the bulk of the fighting force, young boys that have been distorted, that has been misled by using a religious approach, by using that economic approach and many others. That's one group. And that's the bulk. There's another group which next to that, which is, belongs to minority clans or minority groups that have been pressured and subjected to maybe unfair treatment by major clans. So they have sense of revenge, and Shabaab give them opportunity, come and take your revenge, get the gun, kill their elders, kill their intellectuals. Nobody can take you this. So they utilize that sort of grievance in some parts of the society. The third is the core group, which is the leadership, Amniyat, those who are committed to the ideology, many of them non-Somalis. So we're dealing with these three different groups, the bulk of them trying to provide economic opportunity, training, new skills, so that they can be easily employed. The other group who got that revenge, using reconciliation, the elders, that they will not be punished because of what they have done, but they need to recognize that they, and then ask forgiveness, or that process is still there. The third group, I don't think we have a readily available tool for them. The foreigners, they have to go home. This is not their country. And the others, as I said, if they denounce the violence and the extremism, this is their country, they can be part of the mainstream of the society. So there is a possibility of negotiation, reconciliation possible.
Michael, back in the fifth row.
Thank you. Michael Callingard, Brookings and Council for United States and Italy. I was a diplomat in Somalia long ago. I was in Mogadishu before independence and after independence. And I was there on July 1, 1960, when proclamation of independence was made. One question. At the time, there was a lot of interest and concern, not only Somalia, but all the emerging countries of Africa, of how this was going to work out. One cause of concern was tribalism, if that's the right term, the existence of the clans, which in a sense provided some stability and democracy, but also was a cause of conflict and tension, and certainly the history of Somalia as of late 1960s bears that out. So my question is, what about today? Is that still an issue? What is the clan division, and what is the role and significance of that today?
First of all, Somalia has no tribes, but Somalia has clans. Somalia is one tribe. When we got the definition of tribe in line with the tribes in Africa, Kikuyu, Hausa, these kind of tribes, when you look, Somalia is one tribe with the same language, same features, same culture, same everything. But we have clans. And it's the social way of life, the social architecture of the Somalis is clans. Is there. And clans were a social structure that was very useful in the nomadic society, in the rural areas, and in the old traditions. But it shows to be a little bit difficult and maybe not as good as it is in other parts of the social life in the politics. Clans are have a very limited interest, and the scope of the clan is limited, and the national politics is ideas that concerns all the Somalis and all the geographical location of Somalia. Clans, they have a way of life and how to deal with the neighboring clan, not the one next to that even. The traditional laws or the customary laws that depends on the context of that clan. There are certain Somali level customary laws, but mainly it is contextual and situation. So clan is proved to be not very much useful in the politics, national politics, and as you said, it's still there, because in Somalia we don't have political parties, we don't have trade unions, we don't have other professional associations. So the only means of association we have is the clan. So we're using it, and that's how today the 4.5 formula used to reorganize the political topography of Somalia. So clans are still there. They have major influence in the politics, and sometimes good, but sometimes very difficult to make with them align with the modern thinking of state building. So the challenges are still there, but this is who we are, and this is what we are. We use them in as the good trends and the good aspects the clan has.
If I could just interject before going back to the audience, is it time for Somalia to consider political parties? Is that something that should arise either before or maybe shortly after the 2016 elections? Or do you think that that's just going to have to happen if and when it ever happens? Or should it be something that you consider encouraging as president?
No, even today in Somalia, there are political parties established by the civil society members, established by different groups. Groups who are not attaching much hope to the clan politics. The only thing is that still our political structure or the framework is not yet well established. The laws that govern the political pluralism is not yet fully in place. We're working on that in the parliament. So we have the political parties already there, people organizing, trying to organize themselves on the basis of the idea, the political idea they have, and the political vision they have on Somalia. But we cannot say that that's exactly a political party at the standard of other places where the rules of the game are in place. But Somalia, we need to start somewhere, and that's the beginning. And I'm sure it will improve. Somalis are people who are very entrepreneurial, catching up new ideas and improving new ideas. Already it's there. The only limitation that we have is still these rules are not yet finalized in many parts. So we're working on it. And before the year ends, we will have the political party law in place. And you will see political parties mushrooming in Somalia. Well, there are a lot of questions on aid and its effectiveness all over the world, we know. Aid is useful when it's used properly, when it's provided the right time, when it's provided in the right area, and when it's led by the needs identified by the recipients, not by those who provide it. But the recipients will say, this is the need we have today. But many times aid is already decided somewhere else and people got packages that are readily available, but not necessarily that package responds to the needs of the recipient. So it all depends on how we manage the aid, but aid is useful. And in a country like Somalia, in the history of the post-conflict environment, there is no one country in the world that experienced state collapse and came back by its own without international support. Every country that got out of the post-conflict situation was done so with the support of outside, whether that is multilateral organizations, so the UN or regional organizations, or whether it came from friendly country like what the United Kingdom did in Sierra Leone, or what France did in Cambodia, or what ECOWAS, or what now African Union is doing in Somalia. So there's one way or the other always in post-conflict. Otherwise, the transition will take longer and longer, and that's the experience of Somalia. It took us 12 years to transit from stateless to state. 12 years transition. Why? One of the reasons was Somalia was not given the proper aid at the right time and in the right place. So it prolonged the transition. So countries may come back at the end, but it will take long, and they will pay a heavy price on that. So aid is always. Somalia is not an exception in one aspect. It's part of the post-conflict environment in the world. And on the other hand, Somalia is an exception because it's almost now the coming January 2015, 26th January will be 25th year since the collapse of the state in Somalia. A quarter of a century is a long time. So that makes Somalia exception, and we need exceptional treatment even in the aid to Somalia, compared to countries who have been in civil war or state collapse 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. It's different when you were there for 25 years or 20 plus years. So aid is useful if it fills this type of criteria. Somalia is not an exception compared to other post-conflict on one hand. On the other hand, it's an exception because it's the longest state collapse that the modern history of the world is experiencing today. Thank you.
Here in the front row, and then after that we'll go to the gentleman right behind.
Hi, I'm Matt Simonson. I work at the Search for Common Ground. I'm wondering, as your state modernizes and develops, will there be a future for the nomadic herders in the countryside with that lifestyle?
Well, the traditional way of life is nomadic in the rural area, and the Somalis, they are herders looking after their cattle, camel, and goats searching constantly for water and pasture. And traditionally, the traditional conflicts of Somalia was based on that, looking water and grazing for the livestock. Now, that's the way of life. We do not intend to change that life as people calling them all to come to the urban area, no. But we wanted to improve the nomadic life, provide them the facilities that is available. It's very difficult when the society is in, community is in constant move to plan and present, but even then, Somalia has experience in how to deal with this, because this is what we have been doing in the 30 years of we were a state. And so the intention is to improve the life, to provide the veterinary service for the livestock, to provide health service for them, to provide education for their kids, but not to change the whole thing and say now you become sedentary or you become, no, that will not be possible. The Somalis, this is the way of life, and we do believe if we improve that, and we, instead of getting the traditional practices of livestock herding, if we introduce new technology, new ways of herding the livestock in the modern sense, I think economically it will produce very good for the country, and it will give better life for the without changing their way of life and their culture.
Before going to the gentleman here in the second row, let me interject a quick question that's partly related, although it's a little more geographic in scope. Do you have a long-term vision for Somaliland and the Puntland to be reintegrated under common leadership and common governance, or is that too distant of a prospect, even if you might still hope for it, too distant of a prospect for us to be talking about at this stage?
Yes, the unity of the country, making Somalia united again and one country and functioning under one state was a priority for us. And day one, when I came to the office, we started. There is a negotiation is going on with Somaliland in Turkey, Istanbul. There were four sessions in the last year and the beginning of this year, and still this is going on. We are much, much closer than we were 2 years ago, because 2 years ago we were not talking to each other. Now at least we're talking. We have people who are known to be the negotiators of the unity of Somaliland and the rest of Somalia. So this is going on, and we are very much hopeful that it will happen. We work in a framework now to agree that Somalia will remain united. How, on which means, what will be the style of governance, what will be, these are questions that will come later on, but now we're trying to move the obstacles that make the unity to dysfunction in over 20 years now. So with Somaliland, this is going on. With Puntland, the case is completely different. Puntland has never claimed that they secede Somalia. They always have been part of Somalia. But as in my introduction, as I said, the challenge of the center attracting the periphery is one, and it's not only Puntland. In many other regions, the government is continuously working. There is a program we call the stabilization program that's working. And the top leadership of the government is making reach out into the regions and into the different administrations that are existing. Those that were existing before we came, like Puntland, we continued. I visited Puntland, the Prime Minister visited, the President of Puntland visited Mogadishu. We continuously interacted, the Ministry, Education sector working together, health working together, but still we are not as solid as we would have liked to see. So the negotiation is two layers. One is with Somaliland, who claims that they are not part of Somalia anymore. That's a completely different negotiation. And one that says, yes, I'm part of Somalia, but I have X concern or Y concern, or I want to see this thing happen like that, or I want that much of autonomy. This is something that's going on, and still as going on with that dialogue, then making the constitution. The dialogue is taking place in a structured manner on the constitution. Jointly, we established the government of Somalia established, for example, an independent constitutional commission that comprises Somalis, different Somalis, whether administration, whether clans and all this, put together to negotiate on the terms of the constitution. Similarly, another commission are in place, which again consists of different Somalis and regions geographically, on the issue of federalism, what type of federalism, to what extent, to what will be. So these are things that are going on at two levels, one level of unity, one level of state building.
I'm going to take two last questions together, if I could, as a final round here, and then we'll wrap up. So here in the second row, and then over to the gentleman in the front row, and I'm afraid we're going to have to stop there.
All right. President, thank you for this opportunity, and welcome to the United States. My name is Gladius Johannes. I'm from Ethiopia. But my first question that had been asked was the role of the diaspora in terms of capacity building. That part is answered. The other thing, my background is international relations and media and communication. One thing I'm working is on a series of documentary films engaging the African diaspora in development, because partly in terms of the remittances, capacity, and intellectual capacity, all that stuff. But the idea is, how is the current government, is he using media and technology to change the perception of the, or the process, what you guys go through, the opportunities that are available, if they're accessible to other medias, that is there information available for us to change this perception, images, and to engage people in other investment or other in terms of capacity.
And we get us pass the mic right over here, and we'll do the two questions together, if that's okay.
good morning. Thank you, Mr. President, for your for informing this community about Somalia, and I appreciate. As a member of the Somali diaspora, I had the privilege to work in Somalia in the year 2010 and work for the transitional federal government. So there is already a contribution of the Somali diaspora to Somalia. But 40 years ago this year, Somalia embarked on a campaign to improve literacy in Somalia, the Somali Literacy Campaign of 1974-75, which improved literacy levels from 5% to 65%. As we know today, literacy in Somalia is at the lower levels. Even for men, it's about 35%, and for women and youth, it's below that, under 30%. What plans do we have to commemorate the 40-year anniversary of Somali Literacy Campaign? And could this be a tool to help the youth and the communities learn the language, learn how to read and write, and get employment opportunities with education as a tool? Thank you.
Thank you very much, both Dr. Abdennour and Johannes. If I go to the question of the media, Somalia enjoys, I can claim that Somalia enjoys the largest media freedom that exists today in Africa, and in that part of Africa, particularly Somalia, situated. We have a large number of media, both TV and the radio and the websites. In Mogadishu alone, we have more than 24 radios operating, and we have in Somalia around 7 TVs that are on the satellite, people using, and let alone hundreds of websites that are Somali, in Somali language, and operated by Somalis. So that's it. And the media, it is the Somali diaspora and the Somalis who make this happen, even before, long before the media law was in place. Right now we are organizing and establishing the media law. Recently there were discussions with the media people and the Minister of Information in Mogadishu on the media law. There were three sessions, each one minimum of 3 days, some of them 5 days, on the discussing the media law before it's presented to Parliament. Now, this has been finalize it, consultations, and now it's on the parliament. The parliament right now is in recess, but when they come back, it will be one of the first legislations that will be passed. So today Somalia is enjoying a lot of, yes, it's a very difficult area. A lot of media people have been killed throughout the war by the extremists. But even then, the Somali community, but there is issue of regulation and all this is needed, issue of capacity, issue. There are always issues and there are always room to improve what's going on. But compared to many of our neighbors, Somalia is much, much ahead in terms of media today in both. And on top of that, Somalia today, the fiber optic cable landed in Somalia, in Mogadishu, and this media quality and the capacity will further improve with the use of this fast internet facility that's today available in Mogadishu. So media is there and it's very good and very useful. We call it, it's the media is the eyes and the ears of the people. We always tell them and advise them to tell the people good thing, put in their eyes, in their ears, and to show the people also good thing. In places like Somalia, there are so many bad things that can be presented. But what's important is to show, and that slogan is there in the media society of Somalia. When I come back to Dr. Abdul Noor's question about the literacy, that's right, and I'm proud to be one of those young Somalis who went to the rural area for the literacy campaign in the 1974. And recently I visited the place where I went that day a few weeks back as a president again, as a young boy in the intermediate school in those days. So it is there. That was a very, very huge undertaking by that time. When the Somali language was written, then literacy campaign took place and it changed a lot. But as you rightly said, now it declined back again. Today we have 25% of the school-age children going to school. 75% are not going to school. Dr. Abdul Noor has been working in the education, and today, only last year, we succeeded to re-establish the public education, public schools. Before there were schools, but they were private schools. And schools run by NGOs, but even then community contribution, some amount of money has always been there. Only last year we started that there are public schools that by the end of the month the parents are not asked to pay $10. 1,500 teachers recruited and around 50,000 students enrolled the first academic year. The second academic year is starting right now. We expecting more will be recruited, more students will be enrolled, and more teachers will be recruited. It's a matter of, again, goes back to a matter of financing, to rehabilitate schools, to recruit teachers, to pay them, to train them. And this is it needs a lot of resources. We're partnering with the international partners, like the USAID, whom we have extensive discussion with them yesterday and the day before yesterday in supporting the education. But Somalia now has a public schooling is coming back after 23 years. So literacy, as you rightly said, it went back, but we have now in place to establish, first of all, the public schools back, then the adult education system. Then later on, we may take the campaign similar to that of 40 years ago. Thank you.
Well, as we conclude here, let me voice a couple of quick thank yous. First to Alan and Jane Batkin for sponsoring this Statesman's Forum, at which we've been honored to have the President of Somalia today. Second to all my Brookings colleagues, as well as friends here at SEIU, for making this event happen and doing all the hard work with logistics and everything else. Third, I think we should all be grateful to our security personnel. They don't like us to talk about them too much. They do a great job discreetly, but they've had quite a week here in Washington, and we want to extend our gratitude. And then most of all, of course, to our distinguished guest today, the President of Somalia, Hassan Sheikh Mohammed. Thank you very much for being here.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare Podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any other way you can. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.